chapter 26, please. The Passion of the Christ. It's about the last hours before Jesus was crucified. The movie is profoundly impacting different people, Christian and non-Christian, Democrat and Republican, religious and non-religious, are amazed by this movie. There's going to be a program tonight on Channel 2 at 6:30 and then repeat again at 11:30 so you can still come to church. And it's Eye on Riverside County and our own Tom Jordan's program. And he's doing a thing tonight on the Passion of the Christ, and it's excellent. Be a half hour kind of documentary. You guys are in it somewhat. They filmed some of our worship services for this when we went to one of our showings at the movie. They showed some of you guys. I'm interviewed in one part of it, and so I kind of encourage you. Maybe you want to see it, and we just need to be able to answer anybody's questions. You know, and see what's going on. It's interesting to me that I said that when after the movie started, we would take every Sunday morning and kind of deal with the things from the Passion, because there are so many questions. I want you to be able to bring friends and so forth, and even help answer questions for yourself. And then I said we'd put our going through Mark as we go verse by verse through Mark on Sunday evening and Wednesday evening. And it's really interesting that as we're doing that, you know, we begin tonight, as you've been reading, write the same thing on Sunday night and Wednesday night because we're in that section of Mark. And tonight we'll be in 11 and 12, and we start with the triumphal entry, and we move towards the Passion. So it just kind of all comes together. I'm excited about the next Sunday evenings and Wednesday evenings for the next couple of 3 weeks as we deal with it there also. But let me share with you what some people are saying about this movie, and then I want to get into a specific thing here with you. This is from Jack Valenti. He's CEO of the Motion Picture Association. And he said, "I thought Passion was a superior recounting of the greatest story ever told, the last days of Jesus. I cannot but believe that people of all religions will find this truly an impressive and respectful piece of art and realism emerging from the New Testament." James Dobson said, "It is deeply moving, powerful, and disturbing, a film that must be seen." Michael Medved, film critic, radio talk show host, and Jewish, said this, "It is by a very large margin of advantage the most effective cinematic adaptation of a biblical story I've ever seen. And it's the kind of movie that's going to touch people." Cal Thomas said, "As one who has seen virtually every modern epic, biblical epic, I can say, The Passion is the most beautiful, profound, accurate, disturbing, realistic, and bloody depiction of this well-known story that has ever been filmed." And then Rabbi Daniel Lappin says this, "Mel Gibson not only closely follows the narrative of the Gospels, giving the viewer a new appreciation for those biblical passages, but his artistic choices also make this film faithful to the meaning of the Gospels as understood by the church." People agree that the movie is amazing. But is it accurate? Is it fact or fiction? Is it Hollywood or history? Is the movie true or false? If you find yourself asking intellectual or even skeptical questions about Jesus, you are in good company. It's okay to have doubts. The cool thing is, God is not afraid of your questions. God is not intimidated by our doubts or our questions. He is really okay with that. He welcomes your search for truth. You need to understand that you do not have to have a lobotomy to follow Jesus. Okay? You can still have a mind. You can still have a brain. See, when you get saved, everything about you gets saved. Even your intellect and your brain and everything else. And so you need to understand that. Many scientists, lawyers, professors, engineers, philosophers, and intellectuals believe in Jesus Christ. I'm going to kind of do a four-week series. Last week we kind of did a thing, we're experiencing the Passion. making it real for us. And then I'm going to start a four-week series this morning about Jesus inspired by some of the claims that are put forth in the movie, the Passion of the Christ. And today we're going to be looking at who Jesus is and specifically exploring the question, is Jesus really the Son of God? And I'm kind of basing my study on the author of these two pamphlets we've been giving you, the True or False, and then, you know, Experience the Passion of the Jesus Christ, a man by the name of Brian Mavis. And he wrote these, and I've kind of taken from that kind of the direction we're going to go, especially the one on is Jesus who he says he is, true or false? Okay. Controversy has always followed Jesus Christ. If you've seen the movie, you can remember that Jesus was put on trial, an illegal one. You can read this scene. I told you to turn there, Matthew chapter 26. Let's pick it up at verse 57. Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. Well, the chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. At Jesus' trial, they were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Finally, a false claim was made that they thought they could build on. Back then, people were making all kinds of false claims about Jesus. 2,000 years later, people still are making false claims about Jesus. Here's one. Jesus was just a good moral teacher. True or false? The first false claim is Jesus was just a good moral teacher. Have you ever heard it said that Jesus was never, he never claimed to be God, that he was just a great teacher? It's a common belief. Haven't you talked to people who have said that? He's not really the Son of God. He never claimed to be God. He was just this incredible teacher. For example, Gandhi believed this. He writes in his book called The Message of Jesus Christ, and I quote, "It was more than I could believe that Jesus was the only incarnate Son of God and that only he who believed in him would have eternal life. If God could have sons, all of us were his sons. If Jesus was like God, our God himself, or God himself, then all men were like God and could be God himself. I could accept Jesus as a martyr, an embodiment of sacrifice, and a divine teacher, but not as the most perfect man ever born. His death on the cross was a great example to the world, but that there was anything like a mysterious or miraculous virtue in it, my heart could not accept." Let me read to you from the Oxford and Cambridge scholar C.S. Lewis. This is what he says. "I am trying here to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God." That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool. You can spit at him and kill him as a demon. or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come up with any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. C.S. Lewis in his book, Mere Christianity. And you hear that all the time. I've heard that since this movie. What a great moral man. Said some great things. Died for a cause he believed in. And a great teacher. You can't accept him as a great teacher. He's either who he said he was, or he's an imposter, or a lunatic. That's what C.S. Lewis is saying. He has to be one of those things. Who he says he is, an imposter, or a lunatic. Second thing they say about Jesus today is, Jesus is a myth, true or false. Two things could be meant by this. First, people can mean by it that Jesus never actually existed in history. But even non-Christian historians and secular publications don't even accept that theory now. I want you to listen to what Time magazine said about Jesus in an article titled, The Man of the Millennium. Listen to this, December 6, 1999. The memory of any stretch of years eventually resolves to a list of names. And one of the useful ways of recalling the past two millenniums is by listing the people who acquired great power. Muhammad, Catherine the Great, Marx, Gandhi, Hitler, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Mao come quickly to mind. There's no question that each of those figures changed the lives of millions and evoked responses from worship through hatred. It would require much exotic calculation, however, to deny that the single most powerful figure, not merely in these two millenniums, but in all human history, has been Jesus of Nazareth. Not only is the prevalent system of denoting the years based on an erroneous 16th century calculation of the date of his birth, but a serious argument can be made that no one else's life has proved remotely as powerful and enduring as that of Jesus. End of quote. From Time magazine. Even a skeptic, like H.G. Wells admitted, I am an historian, I am not a believer, but I must confess as an historian that this penniless preacher from Nazareth is irrevocably the very center of history. Jesus Christ is easily the most dominant figure in all of history. Did he exist? Absolutely. Another thing people mean when they say Jesus is a myth is that Jesus did exist, but his followers made him out to be more than he was. Jesus was good, but his followers created a myth that he was God. They say that Jesus was saying good things, but his disciples said he was God. They say Jesus did good things, but his disciples said that he performed miracles. They say Jesus died, but his disciples said he resurrected. He wasn't a liar, Lord, or lunatic. He was simply a legend. But listen to what Albert Einstein said in an interview with the Saturday Evening Post in 1929. As a child, I received instruction both in the Bible and in the Talmud. I am a Jew, but I am enthralled by the luminous figure of the Nazarene. Jesus is too colossal for the pen of phrasemongers, however artful. No one can read the Gospels without feeling the actual presence of Jesus. His personality pulsates in every word. No myth is filled with such life. So the false statement, Jesus is a myth, he didn't exist. There is more evidence for the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ in history than there is for the existence of Napoleon Bonaparte. So that he was a myth and didn't exist is not true. That he was a legend because his disciples made up stories about him. Think that through. His disciples were a bunch of cowards. They would make up stories that would cause them to become martyrs and die. They all ran and hid when he was arrested. All of them except John. And after the resurrection, each one of these men became powerful leaders and spokesmen, and they all died martyrs' deaths. What transformed them from being cowards and hiding so they're not arrested and flogged and beaten like Jesus was, to be the men that would stand before the nations and say, "You men of, you vipers, you murderers, you killed the Christ." What changed them? What changed them was the reality of Jesus Christ and his resurrection. They saw a resurrected Jesus Christ and changed their lives. They had a revelation of Jesus. Here's another statement about Jesus. Jesus is the Son of God. True or false? The truth is that Jesus did exist. He claimed to be the Son of God, and he gave proof of it in a whole bunch of ways. Let's go back to the Bible passage and read what happens in this courtroom scene. Let's pick it up where we left off in Matthew 26. Pick it up at verse 63. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." "Yes, it is as you say," Jesus replied. "But I say to all of you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. Then they spit in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy to us, Christ, who hit you?" Jesus had remained silent during the earlier false accusations about him. Now Caiaphas, who acted as prosecutor, judge, and jury, makes Jesus answer. He tells Jesus he has to answer this question under oath if he is the Son of God. Jesus isn't allowed to plead the fifth. He answers and he says, "It is as you say. Yes, I am." If you saw the movie, you remember at this moment, pandemonium erupts in the courtroom. The high priest cries out and tears his clothes. They all begin to scream and yell at Jesus. They spit on him. They walk by him and slap him. They hit him with their fists. This is how the Bible describes it also, not just in the movie. You may wonder, what just happened? What did I miss? What did Jesus say in that statement that infuriated the people to such a degree? What in the world was all this about? As far as the religious leaders were concerned, Jesus just confessed to the absolute ultimate crime. He claimed to be the Son of God. He claimed he was God, and in their eyes, that was blasphemy. He would have been better off to say that he was a mass murderer than to say that he was God. Jesus knew this. He wasn't surprised by their reactions. Their reaction would have been justified if Jesus weren't God, but he was. For Jesus to say that he was the Son of God wasn't blasphemy, it was fact. I've heard people say over and over again in my life, I've heard the cults say to me, "Jesus never claimed to be God. That's why he was crucified. That's why they went nuts in the courtroom. Because he said, 'It's as you say, I am the Son of God.'" I don't know what Bible they're reading, but that's why he was nailed to the cross. No other reason. He was nailed to the cross because of, they said he blasphemed. He said he was God. It's true that Jesus claimed divinity. This was the reason they put him on trial and put him to death. But just because Jesus claimed to be the Son of God, it doesn't necessarily make it true. So let's deal with it. See, if someone you knew claimed to be the Son of God, would you think it was true? You know, one of your friends came to you and said, "By the way, I'm Jesus. I'm the Son of God." You'd think they're nuts. That would have to be proven to you. Richard Bandler tells one story about visiting a mental institution and dealing with a man who insisted he was Jesus Christ. And he meant it, and not just metaphorically, not in spirit, but in the flesh. One day, Bandler went in to meet this man. "Are you Jesus?" he said. "Yes, my son," the man replied. Bandler said, "I'll be back in a moment." This left the man a little bit confused. Within 3 or 4 minutes, Bandler came back holding a measuring tape, asking the man to hold out his arms. Bandler measured the length of his arms and his height from head to toe. After that, Bandler left again. The man claiming to be Jesus became a little bit concerned. A little while later, Bandler came back with a hammer, some large spiked nails, and a long set of boards. He begins to pound them into this form of a cross. The man asked, "What are you doing?" Well, as Richard Bandler put the last nails on the cross, he asked, "Are you Jesus?" And the man answered again, "Yes, my son," Bandler said, "then you know why I'm here." Somehow the man realized immediately who he really was. His old pattern of claiming to be Jesus just didn't sound like a good idea. And he said, "I'm not Jesus, I'm not Jesus." Case closed. But when Jesus claims to be the Son of God, hardly anyone laughs. Why is Jesus believable? Let's put him on trial. Okay. And take a look for ourselves. Let's first of all look at his life. Let's look about things about his life. Number one, he lived a perfect life. He was sinless. Look again at this trial. Notice verse 59, it says, "The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death." This verse points out that even his enemies knew that they couldn't charge him without doing anything morally wrong, about him doing anything morally wrong. They're looking for charges. They have to come up with lies because even his enemies realized, we can find no charges against this man. They couldn't charge him with one legitimate sin. The Bible says he was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Hebrews 4:15. 1 Peter 2:22 says he committed no sin. He committed no sin, nor was deceit found in his mouth. So his life reveals who he was because he lived a perfect, sinless life. Secondly, his miracles. Jesus referred to his miracles as signs. These signs pointed to Jesus' divinity. Of the hundreds of miracles he did, one was especially important. You know what that was? He rose from the dead, never to die again. Again, let's take a look at this trial against Jesus. Look at verse 61. "Finally, two came forward and declared, 'This fellow said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" These false witnesses had twisted Jesus' words. What Jesus really said was, "Destroy this temple and I will raise it again in 3 days." He didn't say he would destroy it. He said they would. Furthermore, Jesus wasn't referring to the temple in Jerusalem, but the temple he had spoken of was his body. Jesus all the time was pointing out the miracles people should be looking for, namely that he would rise from the dead 3 days after giving up his life. In verse 64, Jesus goes on to say in his trial, "In the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." He's really rubbing it in now. That's what made him so angry, because he is saying, "I'm God, I'm coming back to life, and I'm coming back for you." Incredible, is it not? Do you see why they got so angry? Why they began to beat and slap and tear their clothes and spit on him and got so upset because of what he was saying. Another thing I see that proves who he was are his prophecies. Hundreds of years before Jesus came. Now, this could be a whole series. I know that. I'm trying to give you stuff in just one, 30-minute session here. And you say 30 minutes. You've never talked 30 minutes in your life. But it's my intent, okay? But it's trying to put all of this in one session, and it could be a book. In fact, many people have read, written books on this. Evidence That Demands a Verdict. Josh McDowell, get some of his stuff and get some of John MacArthur's done some great stuff on this but I'm just trying to just kind of give you some stuff to whet your appetite and understand who Jesus is. Hundreds of years before Jesus came to earth, many predictions were given about the identity of the Messiah. And Jesus matched each and every one of them. It was like one-of-a-kind divine DNA. Incredible. The movie opens with a verse from Isaiah 53. It's just one example of prophecy that was fulfilled in Jesus. Let's read it again. We read it last week. Let's read it again. Isaiah 53. You want to turn there. So I want you to see this. You can see how obvious it is that Jesus is the fulfillment of this prophecy that was written 700 years before he was born. Pick it up at verse 3, Isaiah 53, 3. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and filled with suffering. Now this is 700 years before Jesus was ever born. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he took our infirmities and carried our sorrows, yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all, 700 years before. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he didn't open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before his shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living, for the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors, for he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. 700 years prior to what Jesus did, it's recorded here. Is that incredible or what? In his book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, Josh McDowell says that the Old Testament contains over 300 references to the Messiah that were fulfilled in Jesus. He asked, what chance did Jesus or any other man have of fulfilling these prophecies? And he refers to the works of a mathematician by the name of Peter Stoner, who calculated the mathematical odds of fulfilling, ready for this, just 8 of the 300 prophecies of the Old Testament. The mathematical possibilities of fulfilling just 8 of 300 of these prophecies. And he says, and I quote, "We find that the chance that any man might have lived down to the present time and fulfilled 8 prophecies is 1 in 10 to the 17th power." This is what it looks like, all right? 1 in 10 to the 17th power. Those are the odds of fulfilling 8. Is that incredible? Of fulfilling 8 of the 300 prophecies about Jesus Christ. 17. Is that incredible? In order to help us understand this staggering probability, Stoner goes on to illustrate it by supposing that we take 10, 17th power, silver dollars and lay them on the face of Texas. They will cover all the state 2 feet deep. Okay? 10 to the 17th power silver dollars. Lay them over the state of Texas. They'll cover the entire state 2 feet deep. That's how big this number is. Now mark, he says, one of these silver dollars and stir the whole mass of silver dollars thoroughly all over the state. Blindfold a man and tell him that he can travel as far as he wishes, but he must pick up one silver dollar and say, this is the right one. We've marked one silver dollar. What chances would he have? Did you understand what I just said? The entire state of Texas, 2 feet deep, silver dollars. Send them. You've marked one of them. You've mixed them all up. Tell him he can go any place in the state of Texas. Blindfold him. Pick a silver dollar. What chance does he have to pick the silver dollar that you have marked? The same chance that the prophets would have had of writing these eight prophecies and having them all come true in any one man. If there is anything that proves to me the reality of Jesus Christ and the truth of his claims of who he is and what he did for us, it's prophecy. And this is just one example, and we can go on and on and on and on. Incredible. His prophecies prove to me who he is. Well, so what, Chuck? Now what? You know? How does this affect my life? Well, it's really quite simple. If Jesus is God's son, the consequences are absolutely enormous. For example, number one, God must exist, and he could be made known through Jesus. Okay? First reality, first truth. If what Jesus said is true, then number one, God must exist, and we can know him through Jesus. That's why it's important. Secondly, and I love this statement, man, he'd rather die than live without you. Is that incredible? Jesus Christ would rather die than live without you, and he did it to prove his love for you. Wow. Third thing, Jesus is alive here and now. Jesus is alive here and now. And he has revealed the way to peace and purpose in life. Jesus once asked his disciples the crucial question. But what about you, he asked. Who do you say that I am? Simon Peter answered, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. Every one of us in this room, and every one of the multitudes of people that are seeing the passion of the Christ are confronted with this question, and they must answer the question, who is Jesus Christ? Was he a moral teacher? Just a moral teacher? Was he a myth? Or is he truly the Son of God? Every one of us in this room has to answer that question. Who is Jesus? If you are ready this morning to confess that Jesus is more than just a just man or just a man, more than just a great moral teacher, more than a myth, that he actually is God, then you need to act. As James 2:19 says, you believe that there is one God, good. Even the demons believe that and shudder. Hear me. Intellectual belief in the existence of God is a start, but it's not enough. What is required is submitting to the lordship and the leadership of Jesus. Did you hear me, church? I'm talking to both believers and non-believers. I don't know everybody here. I don't know where your heart's at, man. I know a lot of you, and I know that you believe in Jesus Christ, but is he truly Lord in your life? If all of the claims we're talking about are true, don't we need to come back to the reality that Jesus Christ must be the number one issue in my life? He must be my reason to exist. He must be the very reason why I breathe. I must be able to say for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Not just added somewhere into the picture of my existence do I have a religious experience and I go to church on Sundays, but it must be my very purpose for life and living, and that's to know Jesus and to be used by him any way that he wants to use my life. We have time to do this. I want you just to kind of watch a video. Listen to this song. I have a song on video. And I just want you to listen to this, and then we'll close in prayer. But just listen, would you?